This is Alfred Beauvais, Editor-in-Chief of AXL. AXL is the American College of Cardiology Extended Learning Series, featuring conversations in cardiology with the scientists who conduct research in our field and the clinicians who are translating that research into clinical practice. You are about to hear an interview from our latest issue. As an AXL subscriber, you will receive 24 new interviews each month. Plus, depending on your subscription level, we'll have access to hundreds of interviews in our digital library. With AXL, you can stream or download your content for convenient offline access on your mobile device, and each interview qualifies for CME credit and MOC self-assessment points. For more information, visit acc.org/ACCEL. Listen now to a talk Spencer King had with Dr. Christopher Granger, professor of medicine at Duke University School of Medicine in Durham, North Carolina. They cover an international multicenter clustered randomized trial to improve treatment with oral anticoagulants in atrial fibrillation.
Chris, this is an exciting study you've been involved in about atrial fibrillation and anticoagulation. Tell us the structure of the trial.
So this was a trial, Spencer, that was designed to address this key gap in care that we have around the world, 34 million people with atrial fibrillation, that 1 in 5 strokes is related to atrial fibrillation. We have very effective treatments to prevent stroke, but they're not being used. Only half the time, even in high-income countries like the United States, of all the eligible patients, and even less than that in middle-income countries. So we took middle-income countries, we took 5 countries, Argentina, Brazil, India, China, and Romania, and we took 50 hospitals, 50 centers, and we randomized the centers. So this is a cluster randomized trial to test an intervention to see if we could close the gap, to see if we could get more patients on guideline-directed stroke prevention therapy.
So let me understand how you did this. So the people all had atrial fibrillation. So you go into one center and you say, you're the control center. We're going to follow your patients. And the other centers, you do interventions. And what intervention do you apply to those centers?
So the intervention was the type of intervention that's shown to be effective in implementation of guidelines. And it really included 2 key elements. One was education, and it was intense education of patients with pamphlets, with discussions with families, with helping patients understand that their atrial fibrillation did put them at risk of stroke that could be prevented, and providers. And the provider intervention included both monograph and webinars about the importance of treatment and things like that aspirin doesn't work, patients really need to be on anticoagulants, and that patients who fall still get benefit from anticoagulants, and patients with prior bleeding still get benefits. So education around patient scenarios. And then the other key feature was audit or measurement and feedback. So the 50 or so patients that each of these sites enrolled in the intervention group, they kept track of these patients. They knew exactly which ones were being treated and which ones weren't and why they weren't being treated. And then they reviewed that. Each of the providers at the intervention sites reviewed that about once a month with their national coordinating center to look for opportunities to get those patients treated. And the good news is it worked. So this combination of a multifaceted intervention.
When you say it worked, the primary endpoint of this was to get them on anticoagulation.
Exactly. So the primary endpoint was the change in the proportion of patients from baseline to 1 year who were on anticoagulation.
Well, tell us how it came out.
So in fact, we did see a highly statistically significant benefit. There was a 9% greater increase in the use of anticoagulants in the intervention versus the control group. And that was about a 3-fold higher likelihood of the change occurring in the intervention sites compared to the control group. And in fact, in the intervention sites, about half of the patients who were not treated at baseline were treated by 1 year.
Do you think you underestimated the benefit? In other words, the control groups you had were aware that you were trying to increase the use of anticoagulation. Did they do it even though they were the control group?
Great point. So the control group, in fact, I think had much better care than the typical unselected patient populations in these countries. So in fact, about 65% of patients at baseline were treated with anticoagulation. For example, in the control group, the patients who started on anticoagulants, by 1 year, 94% of them were still on anticoagulants. So they had very good persistence. They were high quality sites. In spite of that, the intervention on top of good quality care provided this important 9% greater improvement in anticoagulation treatment. Now, importantly, even though this was a secondary outcome, we also looked at clinical outcomes.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, because surely you were successful in getting people on anticoagulation. Did it do any good?
Great question. And even though that wasn't our focus, the trial wasn't powered to look at that. In fact, we saw a 50% reduction in stroke. Now, that's probably
50% from what?
From about 2% over this year to 1%. In the control group, it was about a 50% reduction. The p-value was 0.04, so it was nominally statistically significant.
Did it correlate with who was using the anticoagulation?
It seemed to correlate with who was using the anticoagulation. We're still kind of teasing out the details about which part of the intervention and seemed to be most effective and, you know, what was responsible for the benefit and clinical outcome. There also was somewhat more bleeding, not surprisingly, but not more serious bleeding in the intervention compared to the control group. But the fact that we saw, you know, an apparent benefit in less stroke accompanied by better guideline-based treatment, I think reinforces the idea that this is something really important to be doing, and that this relatively simple intervention that we used in this trial, I think, could be implemented broadly. And we're now in the process of setting up a website that will provide what we think are the very best materials that providers can use in educating themselves and patients, and a systematic approach to measuring how we're doing so that we can move the needle and get more of these patients treated and strokes prevented.
What's the major reason that people do not use anticoagulation?
The single factor that we found that seemed to be most associated with the opportunity for improvement was the use of antiplatelet therapy as the stroke prevention approach. And we now know that aspirin simply is not very effective.
So they think it's anticoagulation light, but the studies don't show that, right?
Exactly. So that may be the easiest thing to do, is take all patients who are being treated with aspirin and really try to get them on anticoagulants.
I've had experience with patients in the past who were advised not to take warfarin anticoagulation because it's a rat poison. And I'm wondering, with the new anticoagulants, is there any psychology that makes people more willing to do that?
I think there is an opportunity. It's a double-edged sword, of course, because they're also more expensive, and some of them are twice a day, and some of them have other limitations. But they do provide, for many patients, they provide distinct advantages over warfarin, including not having to monitor the INR and not having restrictions on food, and importantly, having lower risk of intracranial hemorrhage.
Are there any patients that should not be anticoagulated now, that have intermittent atrial fib, rarely atrial fib, so forth and so on? I mean, everybody gives you a spectrum, or do we stick with the CHADS-VASc rules?
The main group of patients who should not be anticoagulated are those who truly have no risk factors for stroke. So it's a young patient without any of the factors like hypertension, diabetes, heart failure, prior stroke. Otherwise, it's only the patient who's at extremely high risk for bleeding, who's had recurrent bleeding, who's had falls with head trauma, who's had prior intracranial hemorrhage. Those are the patients where anticoagulation may be so high risk that it's not warranted. And then something like left atrial appendage occlusion may be a good option.
There must be a lot of people in nursing homes and such that have a high fall risk classified and so forth, that I'm guessing there must be people who say, well, we're not going to anticoagulate this person, they look old. And is this a mistake?
It's a major issue. And except for the, you know, following common sense, and if it's a patient who's severely demented and, you know, it may not be appropriate to treat with anything for some patients. But patients who are at risk of falling are a population who are high risk for stroke and actually seem to do very well, including on the NOACs, because the NOACs do have lower risk of traumatic intracranial hemorrhage as well as spontaneous. It may be a better option for those who are at high risk of falls.
Well, Chris, this sounds like an extremely important study. I'm excited that you've been able to pull it off in this cluster randomization, which is a growing way to do studies without spending all the resources that exist. I'm also interested to learn some things from you about the care of patients in this modern era that the guidelines should be adhered to. So thank you very much for visiting with us on AXL.
Thanks, Spencer.
This is Alfred Beauvais, Editor-in-Chief of AXL, and you've been listening to an interview from our recent issue. For more information on how to subscribe to AXL and receive additional interviews published each month, go to acc.org/accel.